Jube, 6. Subways were a human perversion that Jube had never quite grown accustomed to. They were suffocatingly hot. The smell of urine in the tunnels was sometimes overwhelming. And he hated the way the lights flickered on and off as the cars rattled along. The long ride on the A train up to 190th Street was worse than most. In Jokertown, Jube felt comfortable. He was part of the community, someone familiar and accepted. In Midtown in Harlem and points beyond, he was a freak, something that little children stared at and their parents studiously failed to notice. It made him feel almost, well, alien. But there was no avoiding it. It would never do for the newsboy called Walrus to arrive at the Cloisters in a taxi. These past few months it had sometimes seemed as though his life was in ruins, but his business was doing better than ever. Jube had discovered that Masons read newspapers too, so he brought a large armful to each meeting and read them on the A train, when the lights were on, to take his mind off the smells, the noise, and the looks of distaste on the faces of the riders around him. The lead story in the Times announced the formation of a special federal task force to deal with the swarm menace. The ongoing jurisdictional squabbles between NASA, the Joint Chiefs, SCARE, and the Secretary of Defense, all of whom had claimed the swarm as their own, would finally be ended, it was hoped, and henceforth all anti-swarm activities would be coordinated. The task force would be headed by a man named Lancaster, a career diplomat from state who promised to begin hearings immediately. The task force hoped to requisition the exclusive use of the VLA radio telescopes in New Mexico to locate the swarm mother, but that idea was drawing heavy flack from the scientific community. The Post highlighted the latest Ace of Spades murder with pictures of the victim, who had taken an arrow through his left eye. The dead man had been a joker with a record as long as his prehensile tail, and ties to a Chinatown street gang variously known as the Snowbirds, the Snowboys, and the Immaculate Egrets. The Daily News, which featured the same murder minus the art, speculated that the bow and arrow killer was a mafia hitman, since it was known that the Immaculate Egrets of Chinatown and the Demon Princes of Jokertown had been moving in on Gambioni operations, and Frederico the Butcher Macellaio was not one to take kindly to such interference. The theory failed to explain why the killer used a bow and arrow, why he dropped a laminated ace of spades on each body, and why he had left untouched the kilo of angel dust his latest victim had been carrying. The National Informer had a front-page color photograph of Dr. Tachyon standing in a laboratory with a gawky, bewhiskered companion in a purple Uncle Sam suit. It was a very unflattering picture. The cut line read, "Dr. Tachyon and Captain Zip pay tribute to Dr. Warner Fred Warren. His contribution to science unparalleled," says psychic alien genius. The accompanying article suggested that Dr. Warren had saved the world and urged that his laboratory be declared a national monument, a suggestion it attributed to Dr. Tachyon. The tabloid centerfold was devoted to the testimony of a Bronx cleaning lady who claimed that a swarmling had attempted to rape her on the path tubes, until a passing transit worker transformed himself into a 12-foot-long alligator and ate the creature. That story made Jube uneasy. He glanced up and studied the others in the A-train, hoping that none of them were swarmlings or were alligators. He had the new issue of Aces magazine, too, with its cover story on Jumpin' Jack Flash, the Big Apple's hottest new ace. Flash had been utterly unknown until 2 weeks ago, when he'd suddenly appeared in an orange jumpsuit slit to his navel to extinguish a warehouse fire on South Street that was threatening to engulf the nearby Jokertown clinic by drawing the flames in on himself and somehow absorbing them. Since then he'd been everywhere, booming along through the Manhattan sky on a roaring column of fire, shooting flame blasts from his fingertips, giving sardonic and cryptic interviews, and escorting beautiful women to Aces High, where his penchant for flambeying his own steaks was giving Hiram fits. Aces was the first magazine to plaster his foxy grin on its cover, but it wouldn't be the last. At the 59th Street station, a slender, balding man in a three-piece suit got on the train and sat across the car from Jube. He worked for the Internal Revenue Service and was known in the order as Vest. At 125th Street, they were joined by a hefty, gray-haired black woman in a pink waitress uniform. Jube knew her, too. They were ordinary people, both of them. They had neither ace powers nor joker deformities. The Masons had turned out to be full of such people. Construction workers and accountants, college students and moving men, sewer workers and bus drivers, housewives and hookers. At the meetings, Jube had met a well-known lawyer, a TV weatherman, and a professional exterminator who loved to talk shop and kept giving him cards.
Lots of roaches in Jokertown, I'll bet.
Some were rich, a few very poor. Most just worked hard for their living. None of them seemed to be very happy. The leaders were of a more extraordinary cut, but every group needs its rank and file, every army its privates. That was where Jube fit in. Jay Ackroyd would never know where he had made his mistake. He was a professional private investigator, shrewd and experienced, and he had been painstakingly careful once he had realized what he was dealing with. If only he had been a little less talented, if only Chrysalis had sent a more common sort of man, they might have gotten away with it. It was his ability that had tripped him up, the hidden ace power. Popinjay, that was the street name he loathed. He was a projecting teleport who could point a finger and pop people somewhere else. He had done his best to stay inconspicuous, had failed to pop a single Mason, but Judas had sensed the power nonetheless, and that had been enough. Now Ackroyd had no more memory of the Masons than did Chrysalis or Devil John Darlingfoot. Only Jube's obvious jokerhood and conspicuous lack of power had spared his mind and his life. That and the machine in his living room. It was dark by the time the A-train pulled into 190th Street. Spoons and Vest walked briskly from the subway while Jube trudged after them, newspapers under his arm. The harness chafed under his shirt, and he felt desperately alone. He had no allies. Chrysalis and Popinjay had forgotten everything. Freud had woken as a bloated gray-green thing with flesh like a jellyfish and had promptly gone to sleep again, sweating blood. The Takesians had come and gone, doing nothing, caring less. The singularity shifter, if it was still intact and functional, was lost somewhere in the city, and his tachyon transmitter was useless without it. He could not go to any human authorities. The Masons were everywhere. They had penetrated the police, the fire department, the IRS, the transit authority, the media. At one meeting, Jube had even spotted a nurse who worked at the Jokertown clinic. That one had troubled him deeply. He had spent several sleepless nights floating in his cold tub, wondering if he ought to say something to somebody. But who? He could whisper Nurse Gresham's name to Troll. He could report Harry Matthias to his captain. He could spill the whole story to Crab Cakes at the Cry. But what if Troll was a Mason himself, or Captain Black, or Crab Cakes? The ordinary Masons saw their leaders only at a distance and frequently in masks, and there were rumors of other high-degree initiates who never came to meetings, aces and power brokers and others in positions of authority. The only one he could really trust was himself. So he had gone to their meetings, listening, learning. He had watched with fascination when they donned their masks and acted out their pageants and rituals, had researched the attributes of the mythological gods they aped, had told his jokes and laughed at theirs, had made friends with those who would befriend a joker and observed the others who would not. And he had begun to suspect something, something monstrous and troubling. He wondered, not for the first time, why he was doing this, and found himself remembering a time long ago aboard the Great Network Starship Opportunity. The Master Trader had come to his cabin in the guise of an ancient Glabarin, his bristling hair gone black with age, and Jubin had asked why he was being honored with this assignment.
"You are like them," the Master Trader had said. "Your form is different, but among those warped and twisted by Takesian bioscience, you will be lost, another faceless victim. Your thought patterns, your culture, your values, your moralities, these are closer to the human norms than those of anyone else I might select. In time, as you dwell among them, you will become still more alike, and so you will come to understand them and be of great value on our return."
It had been true, all true. Jube was more human than he would ever have guessed. But the Master Trader had left one thing out. He had not told Jubin that he would come to love these humans and to feel responsible for them. In the shadow of the cloisters, two youths in gang colors stepped out to confront him. One of them had a switchblade. They knew him by now, but still he had to show them the shiny red penny he carried in his pocket. Those were the rules. They nodded to him silently, and Jube passed within, to the great hall where they were waiting with their tabards and masks, with their ritual words and the secrets he was terrified to learn, where they were waiting for him to arrive, to conduct his initiation.